Welcome to the Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Commercial Investing Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we discuss the relentless pursuit of ROI. Yes, that's right, return on investment and return on inflation. We have a changing future with monetary policy and fiscal policy the way it is, and we need to prepare for it as investors by structuring our transactions differently, and we will talk about that on this episode and future episodes, of course. So we will be back with a fantastic interview for you and a guest today in just less than 60 seconds. Stay tuned.
You know, Penny, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Rich. Jason actually has a 6-book set on creating wealth that comes with over 100 hours of the most comprehensive ideas on investing in business. They're in high-quality digital download audio format, ready for your car, iPod, or wherever you want to learn.
Yes, and by the way, he's recently added another book to the series that shows you investing the way it should be. This is a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Jason actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets that are untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches us how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
He's recorded interviews with Harry Dent, Peter Schiff, Robert Kiyosaki, Pat Buchanan, Catherine Austin Fitz, Dr. Dennis Waitley, T. Harv Eker, and so many others who are experts on the economy, on real estate, and on creating wealth.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered with a savings of $385.
Now, to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series complete with over 100 hours of audio and 6 books, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you.
It's my pleasure to welcome Scott Myers to the show. Scott is an expert on self-storage. And Scott, we're just anxious to learn all about this, so it's great to have you on the show.
Hey, Jason, how are you? Glad to be here.
Fantastic. Well, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started and got a very quick upward ramp up into the self-storage business, owning about 3,000 units.
Yeah, let me see if I can break that down into the small version. How's that? I started out, I think, like most people, investing in single-family homes and got into the rental business. My first start began with Mr. Carlton Sheets and his home study program, and we quickly ramped up that side of the business and had 80 single-family homes when we realized that it was time to make the jump into commercial properties. And I bought an apartment complex and found the economies of scale, and having managers run my business was a good thing. And so we continued to ramp up that side of our portfolio to about 400 apartments. And then, unfortunately, came the attacks of September 11th, which brought our economy into a deep recession. And that, coupled with the fact that interest rates dropped to record-setting levels to spark homeowners to go out and get the economy going again, and with all those first-time homebuyer programs that were offered back during those times, which unfortunately we're paying for these days, they forced all my tenants to go out and achieve the American dream and own their own home. Well, it took me to a place where I almost went bankrupt. And when I went back through and realized, it took a look at the long, hard look at the business and realizing that, there's really wasn't all that great of a business after all, with all the losses that I sustained. And anytime we had evictions or people would just abandon the homes, that maybe now this was just the thing that caused me to go out and look and do something different. And so I began looking at other asset classes to invest in. And, you know, I kept coming back to self-storage. I thought this is just the best. It's the perfect marriage between owning multiple units and the economies of scale and low risk and having managers run it, but avoiding all the bad things in my rental business, which was essentially tenants and toilets. And so I went out and bought my first self-storage facility. And gosh, the quick story is that we've ramped that up to 7 facilities, bringing on 3 more within the next quarter. And we eventually then sold off all our single-family homes and apartments and have never looked back since.
So, Scott, I know that there are several different sort of stratas of the self-storage business. There's the little mom-and-pop facility. There's the automated facility. There is where you may own the real estate, but you get a big management company, one of the big national chains, to come in and either manage it or put their name on it. There are franchises. Can you make the distinction between all of those and then what it is you do?
Yeah, boy, 100 different ways from Sunday to be able to invest in this business. And we've got, I think contrary to at least my belief when I was looking into the industry and maybe others, is that when they see these self-storage facilities, they think, well, gosh, all I see are the public storage and the extra space and the use store it. And, you know, how can I as a small investor get into this business?
They see the big names is what you're
exactly
referring to. Yeah.
Well, when I started digging into it and looking through the statistics from the Self-Storage Association, you know, those big guys, they only own 12% of the market. The vast majority of these facilities, the other 88%, are owned by the small mom-and-pop owners and developers and small-time investors just like myself, so they were every bit as approachable as the folks I was buying my homes and apartments and small office buildings from at the time. And so there truly are a lot of opportunities out there to buy these from the small-time investors. Now, yeah, there's plenty of ways to be able to operate these. We know several owners and operators across the country that are owning and operating these facilities with no managers at all and using these automated kiosks or telephone systems or management companies to run them and do them remotely from across the country. Several of my West Coast folks are looking all over the country and buying up these facilities and managing them from afar to everywhere, right back to the typical mom and pop where the folks, the investors, are buying them and managing them themselves and everywhere in between. But to answer your question as to what we're looking to do, we've kind of found this business model, kind of fell into it. We continued to look for properties in my hometown of Indianapolis and didn't really find anything that met our criteria. And so as we continued to prospect and send out letters to the owners, we kept coming up with the owners calling us back in these secondary and tertiary markets, and we've continued to buy up those facilities in those areas, and we run them with a combination of these kiosks, which is utilizing that technology kind of like an ATM machine to manage them part-time along with part-time property managers, because they're just large enough in about that 200 to 300 unit range that it gives us enough profit to be able to have a part-time manager and then utilize the technology as well. And that's kind of the model that we fell into and we've continued to follow ever since.
So your sweet spot is the 200 to 300 unit facility is what you're saying?
Yep, absolutely.
And when you have that, you have a part-time manager, or maybe some of yours have a full-time manager. Is this person are they an employee of yours? Are you like running a business, or are you running a piece of real estate, I guess is what I'm getting at?
Yeah, very, very good question. I mean, people look at it this different ways, and that also points to how people find these facilities. Sometimes you'll see them listed the traditional means on LoopNet and through the commercial listing agents and brokers, as well as on the business brokerage websites by business brokers, right alongside car washes and coin laundries and bars and restaurants. And so I think a lot of times the owners themselves don't know exactly where to list these things. That's kind of a loaded question, because I do have managers on site at my facilities and also some property management companies for the facilities that we own out of state. But for the facilities that I own within my own home state, those folks are under my direction, but we actually use a PEO, which is a professional employer organization. And so those employees actually aren't my employees. They're employers of the PEO, or the professional employer organization, and we pay them to handle all of our administrative and all of the payroll, as well as any of the HR functions of that employee, even though they are under our direction.
So in my business, I've used a PEO for, well, really 12 years now.
Oh, good.
And so I have a PEO paying my employees, but I pay the PEO. But for all intents and purposes, I'm obligated for their salary and stuff. So
absolutely.
I've got to sort of set their pay level, advertise to find them, et cetera. So
correct.
You set their salary, and I'm assuming, being the prudent businessman you are, you probably have some kind of a bonus based on how the units are rented or the income of the property. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm of the mindset, Jason, that I think everybody throughout the world should be paid for performance. And so within my company, as much as I can control, the only thing that I can control is that, yeah, there is a set hourly rate, and then we do have some milestones and benchmarks for them to meet. And then when they do meet those, then we reward them handsomely. With if we're adding on buildings and putting in new construction in these facilities, then we give them some bonus and kickers to meet a certain occupancy level within certain time frames, as well as keeping those occupancy levels. And they get a certain amount of a bonus per unit that they rent. And so, we try to incentivize every facet of our business that benefits us. We'd like to share that with our employees.
And even when you have the automated type of business with these new ATM type facilities, you still need a person there, right? A property manager or on call, or how do you do that?
Yeah, we do, for two reasons. One, there's still a large segment of the population that just isn't comfortable in using the technology or just doesn't want to, quite honestly. And so we'd like to be able to have set office hours for those folks that want to come in and they want to talk to a real live person and hand them a check and get a receipt for their payment, or just to talk to somebody from time to time about their facility. But then also, you know, the kiosk is fantastic for handling management and leases and rent payments after hours. But at the end of the day, a kiosk can't really sell someone. So they can't come in and negotiate a price and talk to that client intelligently about the competition or make a deal with them. And so I think you give up some sales in those facilities that are run solely by the kiosk and with no manager on site. I think they suffer from a higher occupancy that you would enjoy if you had a true manager / salesperson in that office selling and upselling that client once they come through the door.
When did the self-storage industry really begin? I mean, I remember noticing it about 20 years ago. It always seemed to me, Scott, that this was an optional expense. And, well, I'll let you answer the first question, then I've got another that's sort of the corollary to that, but go ahead.
Sure, sure. Modern self-storage industry in this country dates back to about the 1950s. And in the 1970s, you're right, about 20, 30 years ago is when we started to see the boom, with 1978 being one of the biggest growth and construction years that we've seen.
What happened in 78?
Gosh, I don't know. I think maybe the word got out.
Oh, okay.
At that point, everybody just started building them. It really took off. And perhaps there was some good marketing by the construction companies and the steel manufacturers, but that's we continue to see the big boom.
Very interesting. So here's the thing that I've never quite come to grips with. These are popping up all over the place. There are self-storage everywhere. And I'm not sure how to evaluate this. Is it better for self-storage when the economy is experiencing a rough patch because people are downsizing their office, their house, and they need a storage unit? Or is it better when the economy is booming and people don't feel like they need to liquidate their junk? What's better for you?
Yeah, well, the answer is both, and that is why self-storage has been considered one of the safer and more high-flying investment asset classes in real estate for the past 50 years, because what happens in a good economy is we continue to buy more stuff. And we run out of room in our homes. Our homes, the average home size continues to get bigger and bigger. And back in the 1940s to 50, in the growth boom after post-World War II, average home size is about 980 square feet. We're approaching 2,000 square feet right now, and we still don't have room for all of our extra stuff. But lately, the cities and the towns and the homeowners associations and most cities and towns across the country right now, they don't allow the old aluminum sheds like I had in my backyard growing up, or the mini barns for that matter, and you can't park your boat and RV and extra cars in the driveway or on the street any longer, and people are just busting at the seams with all the stuff that we collect in this country. I mean, let's face it, Jason, we are a country of hoarders and pack rats, and we just can't get rid of anything. So that is causing the huge demand for self-storage, and has so for over the past several decades. So the answer is, in a good economy, yeah, we buy more stuff and we don't have room for more stuff in our homes and apartments and smaller homes that we may have as we're accumulating these things, and so that's pushing out to self-storage. Now, conversely, in the recessions that we've experienced since the 1950s, self-storage has also benefited for the reasons that you just mentioned. Businesses are downsizing. If it's a small business, and let's say they're really small business and they have to move back to the kitchen table or the basement or work out of their garage, well, they've still got inventory. They may have some capital equipment or machinery or something that they have to store somewhere, and they'll put it into self-storage. Likewise, you know, unfortunately, in the economy that we're in right now, and I hate to even say that, but people are losing their homes, and they are downsizing and moving back to apartments or smaller homes. And so what happens is, let's say they had a housing payment of $1,800 a month, and they move to a smaller home or apartment at $1,100 a month. Well, you know what, they're going to have some extra furniture and some extra goods that they can't take with them, and so for $100 a month, they can put it in storage, and they're still $600, $700 ahead for doing so. And so that's why we've seen just steady growth in self-storage. It's just been very, very, you know, moving from in the upward direction from left to the right-hand side of the page for the past 50 years. But actually in a recession, we see just a little bit more of an uptick. And that's why all eyeballs have been on real estate right now. I mean, you can't look in the newspaper or on the internet without seeing how well the self-storage industry and the stocks of the bigger companies have been doing in light of this recession. It has benefited more than any other asset class and almost any other business in the economy that we're experiencing right now.
Have you seen any eBay, what I'm going to call the eBay effect on self-storage? In other words, people getting rid of their junk and selling it on eBay or other places?
Yeah, we have, as a matter of fact, and we kind of benefit from the eBay folks, the professional eBayers, in that they are coming into our facilities and storing their goods. But by the same token, yes, some people are selling their own goods off, but they still have a need for storage no matter what. So in every climate, you know, we even add in a lot of facilities, we have a business called eBay Add It, and it is actually a division of eBay that they've co-branded with the self-storage companies, and they co-locate them in their facilities to allow folks to be able to sell their goods off, and it generates traffic for us as well. So the eBay business and the whole phenomena works hand-in-hand with self-storage.
Very interesting, very interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit more about demand for a moment, if we can, and then I want to get into some specifics of, like, looking for a deal, evaluating a deal, Scott. First of all, areas. Where are the prime markets for self-storage? One of my friends that owns several self-storage units talked to me a couple years ago about the Katrina effect, meaning that some self-storage units in the Gulf Coast were benefiting sort of artificially and temporarily from Katrina because people had a lot of stuff to store while they were rebuilding and construction companies and so on and so forth. And just wanted to kind of have you advise our listeners on maybe some things that aren't real and some things to be careful of in the self-storage world.
That's one of the biggest concerns or fears or objections, I think. The biggest what-if, I think, anybody has, a potential investor and students that I talk to about getting involved in the business, is overbuilding, and or conversely, the other side is, where's the best place to look? Well, I will tell you to look in your backyard first. I think everybody assumes that there's this little city somewhere in the country, Oz, if you will, where the streets are paved with gold and all the self-storage facilities are full and they can raise rents once a month, and that just doesn't exist. There are some areas that are better than others. But the reality is, Jason, is that this business and the markets that we operate in are so small that it's really tough to say that Phoenix as an entire city is oversaturated or Las Vegas is just entirely oversaturated and overbuilt. You can't make those distinctions with storage very aggressively or with a whole lot of surety, because what happens is, with storage, most of the statistics that we look at when we're evaluating a site usually is within a 1 to 3 to 5 mile ring. And we look at the square foot per capita within those rings and the demographics that surround it. And the reason why is because with self-storage, when somebody is looking in the yellow pages or they're going to Google self-storage in their area, they don't want to travel more than 1 to 3 miles to be able to go to a site, and then up to 5 miles in the rural areas. And so if you look at an area, say, within a 1 to 3, even a 5 mile range, and maybe there is a lot of competition, and there's some soft rent and there's some soft occupancy in those areas, you move over another 3 miles and you may find a market that is underserved. And so the markets themselves are really kind of a microcosm of a larger market. And when we look at the statistics and evaluating all the different counties as well as the towns within the country, you can really break that up into certain sections of town and evaluate to determine whether that's a deal or not. So probably not it's a long-winded answer to your question,
yeah.
Probably not a more precise one, but that's really the approach that we take, rather than saying, gosh, I live in California and I don't like my prices here or the cap rates here, so I'm going to go look in Texas for a facility because I understand that state is better, because that's not the case. There are plenty of opportunities in California, just as there are in South Carolina, as there are in Detroit, Michigan.
What are the sources that someone would want to look at? Is there a website or a manual that tells you the self-storage demand or whether a market's underserved or overserved?
Yeah, lots of ways of doing that. On the development end, if you're looking to develop a facility, I think the best thing to do is, if you're looking at a piece of ground or if you have a piece of ground, the best thing to do is there's about a handful of, well, there's more. There's about a dozen or so really good consulting companies that will come and do this for you, and they'll conduct a feasibility study. I've got a handful of folks that I think are just the best in the industry, and they fly around the country and they take a look at these sites and they spend a couple, 3 days out there at the site to determine, hey, this thing, this will work. There's a good traffic count and there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of competition, and it's an underserved market and there's a lot of demand for this on this site. Now, the existing site, in other words, the facilities that are already built. When I'm looking at these facilities, there's a number of tools from the Self-Storage Association as well as information from the local Chamber of Commerce and a number of demographic information you can find out there on the web to determine that essentially the same thing. The historical occupancy and performance of this facility is one of the things that I look at, but there's a number of other tools that you can use that are at your disposal, which, by the way, really don't exist in some of the other asset classes. I think the Self-Storage Association and the publications that are out there from others that are looking at this industry have given us a fantastic set of tools compared to anything else I've seen in investing in single-family homes and apartments and office buildings. And so, yeah, there's a myriad of tools that we could talk probably for another half hour about in terms of demographics and looking at and evaluating a site.
So anything else in site evaluation or selection? Because I want to get into actually doing a deal, Scott, if we can, and talk a little bit about the mechanics of that. But anything else before we sort of leave that the topic of finding the deal, choosing the deal? I know you've got a lot more information and that's your business.
Yeah, typically what I'm looking for in evaluating these deals is I'm a junker at heart. You know, I grew up fixing bikes and selling them to my friends, and then with cars, and then single-family homes, and now in self-storage. And so I look for deals that I can create some value in. So in other words, they've got to have some low occupancy due to mismanagement, some management issues, and some marketing issues that I can fix and remedy. I like the ability to add some profit centers if they haven't added any currently, to be able to add some ancillary income streams. But mostly what I'm looking for are these 4 to 5 acre parcels that have buildings on maybe 3 to 4 acres. So I can turn around the management and I can add those profit centers. And then once I get it to the place where it's stabilized and almost full, then I can go out and build more buildings and create more value in the facilities. And then I, again, look at all the market demographics to make sure that I can, that the area will support that and that there isn't too much competition or overbuilding in that area and that there really is a good probability that I'm going to be able to lease up that facility and add those additional buildings if I put some marketing effort towards it.
Your sort of dream facility, what is the occupancy rate of it, and then where do you get it to when you get it stabilized and working properly?
In the industry, in the self-storage industry, it's widely regarded at 85%. If you're at 85% occupancy, then it's widely regarded as being stabilized. So at that point, at 85%, you've probably got a few units that you're out of. You may be out of a few 10x10s or 10x20s. And so when you get north of 85%, you're probably going to start look at building another building or two on the site, depending upon your lease-up rate. Now, a lot of these facilities we find, I try to buy them at 60 to 70% occupancy and buy them based on that current net operating income or the income stream that it's at. Currently, that way I can sell that to the appraiser, I can sell that to the bank, and if I can buy it based on the current operating income, the current net operating income, then essentially I get the remainder of those units for free.
We'll be back in just a minute.
Are you ready to begin making huge profits in mobile homes and mobile home parks? If so, check out Mobile Home University's Boot Camp in a Box. You'll learn how to find and evaluate mobile homes and mobile home parks, how to drastically reduce park expenses, how to develop an effective management team, how to market and advertise to fill up your park, and much more. The Mobile Home University Boot Camp in a Box is available at special savings at jasonhartman.com.
And so when you find this deal, Scott, what are the mistakes that you can fix that current owner has been making? Is it bad marketing, or what other mistakes are the fixable ones?
I think to take kind of a broader perspective of that, Jason, there's a number of reasons why people sell real estate, and it's no different than self-storage. And so sometimes they just ran out of steam. They're absentee owners, or they've hired the wrong person or a relative to manage it, and they live out of state, and they're doing something different and really don't keep their eyes on it. They could have a bad management company. It could truly just be a marketing issue where they put absolutely no marketing effort at all whatsoever into it, and they don't even have anybody answering the phone. And so there's a number of reasons why these things can fall down to a low occupancy rate, and so we just have to go into those and kind of dissect them and understand what it's going to take to get it back up to the place where it is stabilized, and we can do that through a means of sometimes simply just putting up a sign on the side of the road, flags, and letting everybody know that we're in the business of leasing up units where there was no presence at all whatsoever. There may have been no web presence at all. It may be an owner-operator who just hasn't embraced technology, and we're finding in a lot of our facilities that 80% of our leads that are converted to rentals are coming from the web, and they may not have any web presence at all and just relying on the yellow pages or vice versa. So a number of different ways that we can kind of uncover some hidden values and gems that we can be able able to turn these the management around these facilities and get them exposed and get them leased up.
Good point. So when you find the right deal, now we found the right deal. Well, before we say that, one more question for you.
Sure.
A lot of people I hear, when they're looking for properties like this, they say, this market has been so picked over. All of the people that have taken your course, Scott, or someone else's course, or just got motivated to do it, have scoured the country, and they've looked for the deals, and they've kind of picked over all the good deals. I have a feeling you're going to say that's not true, but why isn't it true?
Well, I'm chomping at the bit because that's one of the also one of the biggest objections that I get. Well, you know what? Typically, Jason, when somebody says they've scoured the country looking for deals, what they've done is they've gone out to LoopNet and they spent an hour on Monday evening looking for a couple of deals, and they're at an extremely low cap rate, and they gave up.
Well, not exactly.
And that's all they've done.
Okay, fair enough. But not exactly,
so,
Scott, that this person has done that.
You know what? Wealth requires effort. And the
right.
bottom line is, you know what? The best deals are most of the time the ones that don't reach the market. There's lots of good deals out there that the brokers are listing and the business brokers are listing. But that's a small, just a very small piece of how we fill our funnel of deals that are brought into us. You know, you got to drive around and look at the facilities in your area. Get out the phone book. Find out what's near you. Google the facilities. Buy mailing lists through the list brokers of the owners in your area and other areas around and start sending them letters. You know, we take a shotgun approach, and there's more than one way to be able to go out and find these facilities, and that one way that are the ones that everybody's looking at that are lit up to the world, yeah, those typically aren't the good deals, and those only are the tip of the iceberg, for you know, lack of a better word, of all the deals that are out there that can be had and be able to be purchased.
Fair enough. And I wasn't really saying that this one particular person gives up too easily, which I certainly agree with you. That happens all the time.
Well, that's okay. I talk to dozens of people that give me that same excuse, Jason, so it's not just one.
Yeah, no. I completely understand that. I was sort of referring more to this army of people that is out there looking in the marketplace being that way. Don't know if you have any comments on that.
You know, it really depends. I can't really say what anybody else's work ethic is. And you know, for everybody to say that that they're all picked over, or even I even get some folks that say, well, gosh, with you out there doing all these deals, you know, is there anything left for me?
Right.
Well, you know what? There's 23 million self-storage rental units out there right now.
Wow.
National Multifamily Housing Council did a study, and there are only 11 million single-family rental units out there right now, and 16 million apartment rental units out there right now. Yet, Jason and I speak to a lot of live audiences all across this country. I'm on a plane about once a week, and every time I ask some people to raise their hands, who's investing in single-family homes? Well, you know, in a room of 200, 300 people, the bulk of the people are raising their hands. And when I ask about apartments, well, maybe half that amount. And then when I ask how many people are investing in self-storage, a lot of times I'm the only person raising my hand. Yet there are more than double the amount of self-storage rental units out there in this country than there are single-family homes that everybody's chasing and beating each other up and raising and outbidding their prices on, almost double the amount of apartment rental units out there that other people are chasing after. And so, you know, the simple answer is, if you want to catch a lot of fish, you fish in the pond that has the most fish, and there's hardly anybody out there fishing in this pond right now. And so myself and other investors, quite honestly, once we get a deal under contract, we can only do so much. We're only limited to the amount of time and the amount of capital and wherewithal from a lending standpoint that we can to chase these deals. And so we kind of shut it down for maybe a month or so, and then we kind of ramp up our marketing activities after that. And it's no different for all the investors across the country. There's plenty to go around.
So now we found that right deal. What is the financing like? What is the process of buying it and doing due diligence like?
No different than any other commercial asset class. And I think I'd like to make this one statement before I forget, in that I think there's so many people out there, Jason, especially in the single-family world, where they own some duplexes or triplexes, and they think, you know what, I really need to pay my dues before I can even have the right to go out and purchase and apply for a loan on a bigger piece of commercial real estate or self-storage. And, you know, the fact of the matter is the lending climate has changed, but you know what? The banks are looking more to the strength of the property than they are to the strength of the borrower when it comes to self-storage, because they know how well self-storage has done over the past 50 years and that it is the best asset class to be able to invest in. It's been the safest and the most stable over the past 50 years. So that's not to say that they aren't going to look at the borrower and the deal globally and look at how his other properties are doing and his credit score and what have you. But you know what? Lenders are still making 80% and higher, we've seen in some cases, LTV or loan-to-value loans on self-storage facilities. These are the banks, first of all, not the ones that we're talking about on the radio and TV and in the news. We're talking about going to the small community banks, the savings and loans, the credit unions, the 1, 2, 3, 4 branch banks in your local area, the folks that have continued to use common sense underwriting fundamentals and practices for the past several years that didn't get caught up in all this subprime mess like the other larger banks. And these folks are very liquid. They have money to lend. And we all know that banks don't make money unless they get money out into play and into the market. And they love self-storage because they can see how well it's doing. 20 to 24% gains quarter over quarter, whereas the rest of the stock market is going in the opposite direction, and most of the rest of all the other real estate asset classes are doing the same. So it's making it easier from a lending standpoint to put these deals together. But also private investors, the private lenders who've been sitting on the sidelines trying to wait this market out, they can see and they understand what's going on with self-storage, and they're clamoring to get in touch with investors and developers like myself and others out there to get their hand in this market as well. So it's getting incredibly easier to be able to put these deals together, and again, much easier than the other asset classes.
I definitely have to comment on your prior statement about finding deals. I've noticed that when we're sourcing properties for our clients, we get calls, Scott, constantly from developers, from brokers, saying, hey, why don't you recommend our project? Why don't you sell our project? And I can say with almost absolute certainty, of course, there's an exception from time to time, that when we find the deal, it's a better deal than when they come to us. And the people get mad at us because they call us and they just won't stop. And we just keep turning their deals down. We don't want to recommend them to our clients. And we'll go out on the web, we'll go to the markets, we'll fly out there. And the deals we source ourselves are almost always a better deal. So absolutely. Very, very true on the point you make. What is the financing like, though? Back to the financing. I mean, is it 25% down? What are the loans like?
Yeah, here's what we're finding. We're still putting deals together at 80% LTV. We lead with a strategy of asking the seller to carry back a second mortgage on these properties. And we've been very successful with that because we got a lot of owners and developers that have had these properties for a number of years that have the basis is paid down, they have very little loan amount, or they haven't paid off at times. And you know what? They don't want to pay capital gains taxes. These folks are very, very tax averse, and so am I. And so this makes it very feasible when you approach them to say, hey, Mr. Seller, you know what? I can probably get a 75 to 80% loan on this thing all day long. No problem, but I'm a little shy on cash. Would you be interested in doing a seller carryback and saving yourself some capital gains taxes and making a little money in the process? And so when you approach it and kind of sell it to them that way, then yeah, it makes sense. If they don't need 100% of their money at closing, yet they've got a low basis and you can give them 80% of that, they can walk away from the business and yet still carry 20% back, save on some capital gains, and still get an income stream and not have to work in the business, starts to make sense. It really starts to make sense.
What are they usually willing to carry? I know every situation is completely different, but is it 15%? So you're putting 10% down, or is there a norm?
There really isn't a norm. I mean, we shoot for what we need to put the deal together. And so depending upon the bank that we're going to use, if they're going to do a 75% or 80% LTV, then we're going to ask the seller to carry the balance. And if they don't feel comfortable with that, then we'll ask them for as much as they can handle to carry, and then we'll use our own cash, or maybe bring in a private investor or lender, or use a self-directed IRA or something along those lines, take out an equity loan and one of our other properties to put the deal together. There's, you know, as you and I both know, there's 100 ways from Sunday to put these deals together. So it really just depends. What we found is, quite honestly, there's so many people that are so tax averse, and with this asset classes, these folks have held on to these things for so long that they are really tax averse. And so we're seeing places where we can go into these banks at a 60-40 and ask for the bank to carry a 60% mortgage on it, and the seller will do a 40% LTV on it, and the bank won't require any cash or any skin in the deal because their risk is only 60% on the property, and they're fine with that all day long. And in some cases, we've had offers I missed out on, unfortunately, a property here in Indiana. It was a 80-unit facility for $150,000, and the seller was going to carry the whole thing 100%. They wanted to move down to Florida, walk away from the business, yet still get an income stream from it. So, and everywhere in between.
So this sounds great, and everything you say makes complete sense. Tell us some of the pitfalls and the mistakes. It seems like there's just no downside so far. What are the downsides? I mean, there's always downside.
Yeah, I think the downside of, first of all, any business and any real estate is people have heard that these things are just easy money and they're cash cows and you don't have to do anything. And no business is easy. I mean, you have to mind it. It's not a hobby. You have to mind it and you have to keep up on it. And probably the lion's share of the work that needs to be done in self-storage, which does differ from other asset classes, is that, you know, you've got a lot of units in one location. You know, for $1 million or $500,000 goes a long way to buy a lot of units and a lot of clients. And so from the collection standpoint, you got to have a good property management software system and somebody who manages that to keep up on the rental collections. There's just more. There simply is more. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. Secondly, I think where most people get in trouble in this industry is that the ability to collect back rent and late fees falls under the individual state's lien laws, which is a fantastic thing compared to the eviction laws that we have in residential real estate. And we follow the process of putting a lien on their unit, and we have to send them certified letters letting them know that we're going to do that and then cut their lock off and auction their goods off if they don't come in and pay for their back rent and late fees. And that's a beautiful thing that we have in no other asset class. You can't do that except within self-storage. But what happens, Jason, is from time to time people get in trouble if they don't follow the letter of the lien law in their individual state. And if they don't send those certified letters out at the correct times or within those milestones, and if they then sell a wrong unit, an incorrect unit, or if they haven't followed the procedure, there can really be some serious repercussions for doing so. And so you just need to know whatever state you're operating in. You can go to the government website. It's real simple, and just print out the self-storage lien law and make sure you follow that to the letter as far as hitting your milestones and your marks and the certified letters before you go and sell a client's goods for non-payment of rent.
And when you sell their goods, I mean, how often does that really happen? They usually make good on the lien, I assume, right?
Yeah, they usually do, because we send all those letters to them, and then we send them threats to auction that off. And the letter of the lien law states that we have to serve public notice in the newspapers. And so, they don't want to be publicly shamed in front of their friends and family and coworkers. And once they do, they usually come down and pay. And so, but there are from time to time where some people just move away and they just don't care. Or people have passed on, and we've had units that way or walked away, and so it doesn't happen very often. But if we do, once again, the beauty of self-storage is that once we do auction those units off, it's, again, the time when those professional eBayers and flea market folks come out, and they look in the newspaper ads and where we advertise for those sales, and they'll come out. And in most instances, Jason, we'll get the same amount in the auction of that unit as what was owed on that unit in back rent and late fees. And so, you know, the downside and the risk is minimal compared to my past life in single-family homes and apartments where you didn't have the ability to do that.
Well, I bet it's even better than that, Scott, because doesn't that person who just bought all the stuff need a storage unit?
You're exactly right. Yeah, once the auctioneer sells us off to the highest bidder and the gavel goes down, the door goes down, they put their lock on it, and immediately we have created another rental until they clear that out.
Yeah, very interesting. Hey, one of my friends that was doing self-storage units, he was fond of the idea, and I don't know if he ever actually did this, of converting some of his units to condos, to storage condos. And they can be for just a self-storage unit for whatever, or it can be for a boat or a car.
Yeah.
Have you done that?
I have not. And here's why, Jason. A very, very viable alternative, if you will, or niche within the industry. And I know a lot of builders that get excited about that because they like building things and selling them off and then collecting a little bit of a residual for having essentially a homeowners association or a self-storage condo owners association within their facility. But this is just my opinion, and my business model is that, you know what? I like being a landlord again because I don't have the tenants and toilets. And so if I sold off the bulk of that asset and the ability to collect a monthly rental on it, then I've just reduced my income. And so I'd rather have the rental on this than have to go out and build more condos and sell those off and only get a little amount of monthly passive income. I like lots of monthly passive income, and I'm looking to grow that. So not saying that it's wrong, it's just another way to go, but I like being a landlord again. I'm creating massive amounts of wealth this way.
Yeah, I've found that to be true. The people that are doing the buy and hold always seem to end up with real wealth versus the buy and sellers or they have spending money. Scott, what else would you like people to know about self-storage? And of course, we're going to offer, and we'll record this afterwards, a way where they can get some free stuff on you and then also look toward purchasing an educational program from you as well. And so we'll get that all set up on our website. But what else would you like people to know?
I guess if you would, perhaps I could get on my soapbox and just say I think there's so many people out there that aren't looking at anything right now, and they've gotten so scared of what they're seeing and hearing on the news about how bad the markets are and the banks aren't lending any money and real estate is a horrible place to be. And you know what, Jason, there's you and I both know that more millionaires were made in this country during the Great Depression than any other time in our country's history. And I certainly wouldn't use the D word to explain the economy that we're in right now, but we are in a recession, but that just means that there's more opportunities out there right now. There is so much real estate that has been beaten down for no apparent reason. Interest rates are at record-setting lows right now compared to where we were in the 80s when we went through that last huge recession where prime was at 18%. And the truth of the matter is that only 94% of all the loans out there on homes are in trouble right now. So the fundamentals and the foundation of our economy right now is pretty darn good and pretty darn strong. And so I wouldn't hesitate to go out and look at anything, and we're trying to take advantage of those opportunities that exist out there. There's the same number of reasons, the same type of reasons that people are selling real estate as they always have, and no matter what the economy is like or what's going on in the markets. There's, unfortunately, death. There's divorce, there's bankruptcy, there's health issues, capital issues, people that need to pay taxes. And so these people are continuing to sell their properties. They're trading in, they're trading up, and they've depreciated their assets. And so the opportunities are out there. The money is out there. These banks, the community banks, savings and loans, credit unions are lending money, and they love self-storage. By the way, Jason, self-storage has the lowest loan default rate of any other commercial asset class at only 8% compared to apartments and retail strip centers and office buildings that are all hovering between 50 to 60%. And those are true statistics. So banks know that self-storage is a safe place for their money, and the private investors are out there throwing money at developers and investors that are investing in this. So I haven't seen any other time in our history where the investing climate, especially for self-storage, as well as it's doing right now in this recession, if there's a better business out there right now, then somebody please call me or email me and tell me, and I'll be the first to sign up, because I haven't found anything right now. But at the end of the day, if you find that self-storage isn't good enough for you, or you don't believe a word that I say, then my advice is to just get out and do something right now. If you're looking to invest in real estate, there are opportunities and there is money out there to be able to take advantage of what's going on in this recession right now.
I would definitely agree. Scott, thank you so much for joining us on the show, and thank you for your insight as well.
Hey, my pleasure, Jason.
Are you interested in a property outside of our network? Do you need a second opinion? No problem. Let Jason's experts evaluate the deal. For more information, go to jasonhartman.com now. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.